46. After he and Rachel were done talking, Judd put on his light coat. The day had clouded up and the wind had begun to blow, and crossed the road to Lewis's house, pausing on his side of the road to look carefully for trucks before crossing. It was the trucks that had been the cause of all this. The damned trucks. Except it wasn't. He could feel the Pet Cemetery pulling at him. And something beyond. Where once its voice had been a kind of seductive lullaby, the voice of possible comfort and a dreamy sort of power, it was now lower and more than ominous. It was threatening and grim. Stay out of this, you. But he would not stay out of it. His responsibility went back too far. He saw that Lewis's Honda Civic was gone from the garage. There was only the big Ford wagon, looking dusty and unused. He tried the back door of the house and found it open. Lewis, he called, knowing that Lewis was not going to answer, but needing to cut across the heavy silence of this house somehow. Oh, getting old was starting to be a pain in the ass. His limbs felt heavy and clumsy most of the time. His back was a misery to him after a mere 2 hours in the garden. And it felt as if there was a screw auger planted in his left hip. He began to go through the house methodically, looking for the signs he had to look for. World's oldest housebreaker, he thought, without much humor, and went right on looking. He found none of the things that would have seriously upset him. Boxes of toys held back from the Salvation Army, clothes for a small boy put aside behind a door or in the closet or under a bed. Perhaps worst of all, the crib carefully set up in Gage's room again. There were absolutely none of the signs, but the house still had an unpleasant blank feel, as if it were waiting to be filled with, well, something. Perhaps I had to take a little run out to Pleasant View Cemetery, see if anything's doing out there. Might even run into Lewis Creed. I could buy him a dinner or something. But it wasn't at Pleasant View Cemetery in Bangor that there was danger. The danger was here, in this house, and beyond it. Judd left again and crossed the road to his own house. He pulled a six-pack of beer out of the kitchen fridge and took it into the living room. He sat down in front of the bay window that looked out on the Creed house, cracked a beer, and lit a cigarette. The afternoon drew down around him, and as it did so often these last few years, he found his mind turning back and back in a widening gyre. If he had known the run of Rachel Creed's earlier thoughts, he could have told her that what her psych teacher had told her was maybe the truth. But when you got older, that dimming function of the memory broke down little by little, the same way that everything else in your body broke down. And you found yourself recalling places and faces and events with an eerie surety. Sepia-toned memories grew bright again, the colors truing up, the voices losing that tinny echo of time and regaining their original resonance. It wasn't informational breakdown at all, Judd could have told him. The name for it was senility. In his mind, Judd again saw Lester Morgan's bull, Hanratty, his eyes rimmed with red, charging at everything in sight, everything that moved, charging at trees when the wind jigged the leaves. Before Lester gave up and called it off, every tree in Hanratty's fenced meadow was gored with his brainless fury, and his horns were splintered and his head was bleeding. When Lester put Hanratty down, Lester had been sick with dread, the way Judd himself was right now. He drank beer and smoked. Daylight faded. He did not put on the light. Gradually, the tip of his cigarette became a small red pip in the darkness. He sat and drank beer and watched Lewis Creed's driveway. He believed that when Lewis came home from wherever he was, he would go over and have a little talk with him. Make sure Lewis wasn't planning to do anything he shouldn't. And still he felt the soft tug of whatever it was, whatever sick power it was that inhabited that devil's place, reaching down from its bluff of rotted stone where all those cairns had been built. Stay out of this, you. Stay out of it, or you're going to be very, very sorry. Ignoring it as best he could, Judd sat and smoked and drank beer and waited. 47. While Judd Crandall was sitting in the ladder-backed rocker and watching for him out of his bay window, Lewis was eating a big, tasteless dinner in the Howard Johnson's dining room. The food was plentiful and dull, exactly what his body seemed to want. Outside, it had grown dark. The headlights of the passing cars probed like fingers. He shoveled the food in. A steak. A baked potato. The side dish of beans, which were a bright green nature had never intended. A wedge of apple pie with a scoop of ice cream on top of it, melting into a soft drool. He ate at a corner table, watching people come and go, wondering if he might not see someone he knew. In a vague way, he rather hoped that would happen. It would lead to questions. Where's Rachel? What are you doing here? How's it going? And perhaps the questions would lead to complications. And maybe complications were what he really wanted, a way out. And as a matter of fact, a couple that he did know came in just as he was finishing his apple pie and his second cup of coffee. Rob Grinnell, a banker doctor, and his pretty wife, Barbara. He waited for them to see him, sitting here in the corner at his table for one. But the hostess led them to the booths on the far side of the room, and Lewis lost sight of them entirely, except for an occasional glimpse of Grinnell's prematurely graying hair. The waitress brought Lewis his check. He signed for it, jotting his room number under his signature, and left by the side door. Outside, the wind had risen to near gale force. It was a steady, droning presence, making the electrical wires hum oddly. He could see no stars, but had a sense of clouds rushing past overhead at high speed. Lewis stood on the walk for a moment, hands in pockets, face tilted into that wind. Then he turned back and went up to his room and turned on the television. It was too early to do anything serious, and that night wind was too full of possibilities. It made him nervous. He watched 4 hours of TV, 8 back-to-back half-hour comedy programs. He realized it had been a very long time since he had watched so much TV in a steady, uninterrupted stream. He thought that all the female leads in the sitcoms were what he and his friends had called cock-teasers back in high school. In Chicago, Dory Goldman was wailing, "Fly back? Honey, why do you want to fly back? You just got here." In Ludlow, Judd Crandall sat by his bay window, smoking and drinking beer, motionless, examining the mental scrapbook of his own past, and waiting for Lewis to come home. Sooner or later, Lewis would come home, just like Lassie in that old movie. There were other ways up to the cemetery and the place beyond, but Lewis didn't know them. If he intended to do it, he would begin from his own dooryard. Unaware of these other happenings, like slow-moving projectiles aimed not at where he was, but rather in the best ballistics tradition at the place where he would be, Lewis sat and watched the Hojo color television set. He had never seen any of these programs before, but he had heard vague rumors of them. A black family, a white family, a little kid who was smarter than the rich grown-ups he lived with, a woman who was single, a woman who was married, a woman who was divorced. He watched it all, sitting in the Hojo chair and glancing out every now and then at the blowy night. When the 11 o'clock news came on, he turned the television set off and went out to do what he had decided to do, perhaps at the very moment he had seen Gage's baseball cap lying in the road full of blood. The coldness was on him again, stronger than ever. But there was something beneath it, an ember of eagerness or passion or perhaps lust. No matter. It warmed him against the cold and kept him together in the wind. As he started the Honda's engine, he thought that perhaps Judd was right about the growing power of that place, for surely he felt it around him now, leading or pushing him on. And he wondered, could I stop it? Could I stop even if I wanted to? 48. You want to what? Dory asked again. Rachel, you're upset. A night's sleep. Rachel only shook her head. She could not explain to her mother why she had to go back. The feeling had risen in her the way a wind rises, an early stirring of the grasses hardly noticed. Then the air begins to move faster and harder, and there is no calm left. Then the gusts become hard enough to make eerie screaming noises around the eaves. Then they are shaking the house, and you realize that this is something like a hurricane. And if the wind gets much higher, things are going to fall down. It was 6 o'clock in Chicago. In Bangor, Lewis was just sitting down to his big, tasteless meal. Rachel and Ellie had done no more than pick at their dinners. Rachel kept raising her eyes from her plate to find her daughter's dark glance upon her, asking her what she was going to do about whatever trouble Daddy was in, asking her what she was going to do. She waited for the telephone to ring, for Judd to call and tell her that Lewis had come home, and once it did ring, she jumped and Ellie almost spilled her glass of milk. But it was only a lady from Dory's Bridge Club wanting to know if she had gotten home all right. They were having their coffee when Rachel had abruptly tossed down her napkin and said, "Daddy, Mom, I'm sorry, but I have to go home. If I can get a plane, I'm going tonight." Her mother and father had gaped at her, but Ellie had closed her eyes in an adult expression of relief. It would have been funny if not for the waxy, stretched quality of her skin. They did not understand, and Rachel could no more explain than she could have explained how those tiny puffs of wind, so faint they can barely stir the tips of short grass, can gradually grow in power until they can knock a steel building flat. She did not believe that Ellie had heard a news item about the death of Victor Pascal and filed it away in her subconscious. "Rachel, honey," her father spoke slowly, kindly, the way one might speak to someone in the grip of a transitory but dangerous hysteria. "This is all just a reaction to your son's death. You and Ellie are both reacting strongly to that. And who could blame you? But you'll just collapse if you try to..." Rachel did not answer him. She went to the telephone in the hall, found Airlines in the yellow pages, and dialed Delta's number, while Dory stood close by, telling her they ought to just think about this, didn't she think? They ought to talk about it, perhaps make a list. And beyond her, Ellie stood, her face still dark, but now it was lit by enough hope to give Rachel some courage. "Delta Airlines," the voice on the other end said brightly. "This is Kim. May I help you?" "I hope so," Rachel said. "It's extremely important that I get from Chicago to Bangor tonight. It's a bit of an emergency, I'm afraid. Can you check the connections for me?" Dubiously, "Yes, ma'am, but this is very short notice." "Well, please check," Rachel said, her voice cracking a little. "I'll take standby, anything." "All right, ma'am. Please hold." The line became smoothly silent. Rachel closed her eyes, and after a moment she felt a cool hand on her arm. She opened her eyes and saw that Ellie had moved next to her. Irwin and Dory stood together, talking quietly and looking at them. "The way you look at people you suspect of being lunatics," Rachel thought wearily. She mustered a smile for Ellie. "Don't let them stop you, Mommy," Ellie said in a low voice. "Please." "No way, big sister," Rachel said, and then winced. It was what they had called her ever since Gage had been born. But she was no one's big sister anymore, was she? "Thank you," Ellie said. "It's very important, isn't it?" Ellie nodded. "Honey, I believe that it is. But you could help me if you could tell me more. Is it just the dream?" "No," Ellie said. It's everything now. It's running all through me now. Can't you feel it, Mommy? Something like a wind." Ellie sighed shakily. "But you don't know what it is? You don't remember anything more about your dream?" Ellie thought hard and then shook her head reluctantly. "Daddy, church, and Gage. That's all I remember. But I don't remember how they go together, Mommy." Rachel hugged her tightly. "It'll be all right," she said. But the weight on her heart did not lessen. "Hello, ma'am," the reservations clerk said. "Hello?" Rachel tightened her grip on both Ellie and the phone. "I think I can get you to Bangor, ma'am, but you're going to be getting in very late." "That doesn't matter," Rachel said. "Do you have a pen?" "It's complicated." "Yes, right here," Rachel said, getting a stub of pencil out of the drawer. She found the back of an envelope to write on. Rachel listened carefully, writing down everything. When the airline clerk finished, Rachel smiled a little and made an O with her thumb and forefinger to show Ellie that it was going to work. "Probably going to work," she amended. "Some of the connections looked very, very tight, especially in Boston. Please book it all, Rachel said, and thank you. Kim took Rachel's name and credit card number. Rachel hung up at last, limp, but relieved. She looked at her father. Daddy, will you drive me to the airport?
Maybe I ought to say no, Goldman said. I think I might have a responsibility to put a stop to this craziness.
Don't you dare, Ellie cried shrilly. It's not crazy, it's not. Goldman blinked and stepped back at this small but ferocious outburst.
Drive her, Irwin, Dory said quietly into the silence that followed. I've begun to feel nervous, too. I'll feel better if I know Lewis is all right.
Goldman stared at his wife, and at last turned to Rachel.
I'll drive you, if it is what you want, he said.
Rachel, I'll come with you, if you want that. Rachel shook her head. Thank you, Daddy. But I got all the last seats. It's as if God saved them for me.
Irwin Goldman sighed. At that moment he looked very old, and it suddenly occurred to Rachel that her father looked like Judd Crandall.
You have time to pack a bag if you want, he said. We can be at the airport in 40 minutes if I drive the way I used to when your mother and I were first married. Find her your tote bag, Dory.
Mommy,
Ellie said. Rachel turned toward her. Ellie's face was now sheened with light sweat.
What, honey?
Be careful, Mommy, Ellie said. 49. The trees were only moving shapes against a cloudy sky, backlit by the glow from the airport not too far distant. Lewis parked the Honda on Mason Street. Mason bordered Pleasant View on its south side, and here the wind was almost strong enough to rip the car door out of his hand. He had to push hard to shut it. The wind rippled at his jacket as he opened the Honda's hatch and took out the piece of tarpaulin he had cut and wrapped around his tools. He was in a wing of darkness between two street lights, standing on the curb with the canvas-wrapped bundle cradled in his arms, looking carefully for traffic before crossing to the wrought-iron fence which marked the boundary of the graveyard. He did not want to be seen at all, if he could help it, not even by someone who would notice him and forget him the next second. Beside him, the branches of an old elm groaned restlessly in the wind, making Lewis think of jackleg necktie parties. God, he was so scared. This wasn't wild work. It was mad work. No traffic. On the Mason Street side, the street lamps marched away in perfect white circles, casting spotlights on the sidewalk where, during the days after Fairmont Grammar School's let out, boys would ride bikes and girls would jump rope and play hopscotch, never noticing the nearby graveyard, except perhaps at Halloween, when it would acquire a certain spooky charm. Perhaps they would dare to cross their suburban street and hang a paper skeleton on the wrought-iron bars of the high fence, giggling at the old jokes. It's the most popular place in town. People are dying to get in. Why is it wrong to laugh in the graveyard? Because everyone who lives there is always in a grave mood.
Gage, he muttered. Gage was in there, behind that wrought-iron fence, unjustly imprisoned under a blanket of dark earth, and that was no joke.
Gonna break you out, Gage, he thought. Gonna break you out, big guy, or die trying.
Lewis crossed the street with his heavy bundle in his arms, stepped up on the other curb, glanced both ways again, and tossed the canvas roll over the fence. It clinked softly as it struck the ground on the far side. Dusting his hands, Lewis walked away. He had marked the place in his mind. Even if he forgot, all he really had to do was follow the fence on the inside until he was standing opposite his Civic, and he would fall over it. But would the gate be open this late? He walked down Mason Street to the stop sign, the wind chasing him and worrying his heels. Moving shadows danced and twined on the roadway. He turned the corner onto Pleasant Street, still following the fence. Car headlights splashed up the street and Lewis stepped casually behind an elm tree. It wasn't a cop car, he saw, only a van moving toward Hammond Street and probably the turnpike. When it was well past him, Lewis walked on.
Of course it'll be unlocked. It's got to be.
He reached the gate, which formed a cathedral shape in wrought iron, slim and graceful in the moving wind shadows thrown by the street lights. He reached out and tried it.
Locked.
You stupid fool, of course it's locked. Did you really think anyone would leave a cemetery inside the municipal city limits of any American city unlocked after 11 o'clock? No one is that trusting, dear man, not anymore. So what do you do now? Now you'd have to climb and just hope no one happened to glance away from the Carson show long enough to see him monkeying up the wrought iron like the world's oldest, slowest kid. Hey, police, I just saw the world's oldest, slowest kid climbing into Pleasant View Cemetery. Looked like he was dying to get in. Yeah, looked like a grave matter to me. Kidding? Oh, no, I'm in dead earnest. Maybe you ought to dig into it. Lewis continued up Pleasant Street and turned right at the next intersection. The high iron fence marched along beside him, relentlessly. The wind cooled and evaporated the drops of sweat on his forehead and in the hollows of his temples. His shadow waxed and waned in the streetlights. Every now and then he glanced at the fence, and then he stopped and forced himself to really look at it. "You're going to climb that, baby? Don't make me laugh." Lewis Creed was a fairly tall man, standing a bit over 6'2", but the fence was easily 9 feet high, each wrought iron stave ending in a decorative arrow-like point. Decorative, that is, until you happen to slip while swinging your leg over, and the force of your suddenly dropping 200 pounds drove one of those arrow points into your groin, exploding your testicles. And there you would be, skewered like a pig at a barbecue, hollering until someone called for the police, and they came and pulled you off and took you to the hospital. The sweat continued to flow, sticking his shirt to his back. All was silent except for the faint hum of late traffic on Hammond Street. There had to be a way to get in there. Had to be. Come on, Lewis, face the facts. You may be crazy, but you're not that crazy. Maybe you could shinny up to the top of that fence, but it would take a trained gymnast to swing over those points without sticking himself on them. And even supposing you can get in, how are you going to get yourself and Gage's body out? He went on walking, vaguely aware that he was circling the cemetery, but not doing anything constructive. All right, here's the answer. I'll just go on home to Ludlow tonight and come back tomorrow in the late afternoon. I'll go in through the gate around 4 o'clock and find a place to hole up until it's midnight or a little later. I will, in other words, put off until tomorrow what I should have been smart enough to think of today. Good idea, O great Swami Lewis. And in the meantime, what do I do about that great big bundle of stuff I threw over the wall? Pick, shovel, flashlight. You might as well stamp grave-robbing equipment on every damn piece of it. It landed in the bushes. Who's going to find it, for Christ's sake? On measure, that made sense. But this was no sensible errand he was on, and his heart told him quietly and absolutely that he couldn't come back tomorrow. If he didn't do it tonight, he would never do it. He would never be able to screw himself up to this crazy pitch again. This was the moment, the only time for it he was ever going to have. There were fewer houses up this way. An occasional square of yellow light gleamed on the other side of the street, and once he saw the gray-blue flicker of a black-and-white TV. And looking through the fence, he saw that the graves were older here, more rounded, sometimes leaning forward or backward with the freezes and thaws of many seasons. There was another stop sign up ahead, and another right turn would put him on a street roughly parallel to Mason Street, where he had begun. And when he got back to the beginning, what did he do? Collect $200 and go around again? Admit defeat? Car headlights turned down the street. Lewis stepped behind another tree, waiting for it to pass. This car was moving very slowly, and after a moment a white spotlight stabbed out from the passenger side and ran flickering along the wrought iron fence. His heart squeezed painfully in his chest. It was a police car, checking the cemetery. He pressed himself tight against the tree, the rough bark against his cheek, hoping madly that it was big enough to shield him. The spotlight ran toward him. Lewis put his head down, trying to shield the white blur of his face. The spotlight reached the tree, disappeared for a moment, and then reappeared on Lewis's right. He slipped around the tree a little. He had a momentary glimpse of the dark bubbles on the cruiser's roof. He waited for the taillights to flare a brighter red, for the doors to open, for the spotlight to suddenly turn back on its ball joint, hunting for him like a big white finger. "Hey, you behind that tree. Come out where we can see you. and we want to see both hands empty. Come out now.
The police car kept on going. It reached the corner, signaled with sedate propriety, and turned left. Lewis collapsed back against the tree, breathing fast, his mouth sour and dry. He supposed they would cruise past his parked Honda, but that didn't really matter. Parking from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m. was legal on Mason Street. There were plenty of other cars parked along it. Their owners would belong to the scattering of apartment buildings on the other side of the street. Lewis found himself glancing up at the tree he had hidden behind. Just above his head, the tree forked. He supposed he could... Without allowing himself to think about it further, he reached into the fork and pulled himself up, scrambling with his tennis shoes for purchase, sending a little shower of bark down to the sidewalk. He got a knee up, and a moment later, he had one foot planted solidly in the crotch of the elm. If the police car should happen to come back, their spotlight would find an extremely peculiar bird in this tree. He ought to move quickly. He pulled himself up onto a higher branch, one which overhung the very top of the fence. He felt absurdly like the 12-year-old he supposed he had once been. The tree was not still. It rocked easily, almost soothingly, in the steady wind. Its leaves rustled and murmured. Lewis assessed the situation, and then, before he could get cold feet, he dropped off into space, holding onto the branch with his hands laced together over it. The branch was perhaps a little thicker than a brawny man's forearm. With his sneakers dangling about 8 feet over the sidewalk, he pulled himself hand for hand toward the fence. The branch dipped, but showed no sign of breaking. He was faintly aware of his shadow following along on the cement sidewalk below him, an amorphous black ape shape. The wind chilled his hot armpits, and he found himself shivering in spite of the sweat running down his face and neck. The branch dipped and swayed with his movements. The farther out he moved, the more pronounced the dip became. His hands and wrists were getting tired now, and he was afraid that his sweat-greasy palms might slip. He reached the fence. His tennis shoes dangled perhaps a foot below the arrow tips. The tips did not look blunt at all from this angle. They looked very sharp. Sharp or not, he suddenly realized it was not just his balls that were at risk here. If he fell and hit one of those things dead on, his weight would be enough to drive it all the way up into his lungs. The returning cops would find an early and extremely grisly Halloween decoration on the Pleasant View fence. Breathing fast, not quite gasping, he groped for the fence points with his feet, needing a moment's rest. For a moment, he hung there, his feet moving in an air dance, searching but not finding. Light touched him and grew. Oh, Christ, that's a car. There's a car coming. He tried to shuffle his hands forward, but his palms slipped. His interlaced fingers were coming apart. Still groping for purchase, he turned his head to the left, looking under his straining arm. It was a car, but it shot through the intersection up the street without slowing. Lucky. If it had... His hand slipped again. He felt bark sift down onto his hair. One foot found purchase, but now his other pants leg had caught on one of the arrow points. And Christ, he wasn't going to be able to hang on much longer. Desperately, Lewis jerked his leg. The branch dipped. His hand slipped again. There was a mutter of tearing cloth. Then he was standing on two of the arrow points. They dug into the soles of his tennis shoes, and the pressure quickly became painful. But Lewis stood on them anyway. The relief in his hands and arms was greater than the pain in his feet. What a figure I must cut, Lewis thought with dim and dismal amusement. Holding the branch with his left hand, he wiped his right hand across his jacket. Then he wiped off the left, while he held with the right. He stood on the points for a moment longer, and then slipped his hands forward along the branch. It was slim enough for him to be able to lace his fingers together comfortably now. He swung forward like Tarzan, feet leaving the arrow points. The branch dipped alarmingly, and he heard an ominous cracking sound. He let go, dropping on faith. He landed badly. One knee thudded against a gravestone, sending a lance of pain up his thigh. He rolled over on the grass, holding the knee, lips skinned back in something like a grin, hoping that he hadn't shattered his kneecap. At last, the pain began to fade a little, and he found that he could flex the joint. But it'd be all right if he kept moving and didn't allow it to stiffen up on him. Maybe. He got to his feet and started to walk along the fence back toward Mason Street and his equipment. His knee was bad at first, and he limped, but the pain smoothed out to a dull ache as he went. There was aspirin in the Honda's first aid kit. He should have remembered to bring that with him. Too late now. He kept an eye out for cars and faded back deeper into the cemetery when one came.
On the Mason Street side, which was apt to be better traveled, he kept well back from the fence until he was opposite the Civic. He was about to trot down to the fence and pull his bundle out of the bushes when he heard footfalls on the sidewalk and a woman's low laughter. He sat down behind a large grave marker. He had hurt his knee too much to squat, and watched a couple walk up the far side of Mason Street. They were walking with their arms about each other's waists, and something about their movements from one white pool of light to the next made Lewis think of some old TV show. In a moment he had it. The Jimmy Durante hour. What would they do if he rose up now, a wavering shadow in this silent city of the dead, and cried hollowly across to them, "Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are." They stopped in the pool of light just beyond his car and embraced. Watching them, Lewis felt a kind of sick wonder and self-loathing. Here he was, crouched behind a tombstone like a subhuman character in some cheap comic book story, watching lovers. "Is the line so thin, then?" he wondered. And that thought also had a ring of familiarity. "So thin you can simply step over it with this little fuss, muss, and bother, climb a tree, shinny along a branch, drop into a graveyard, watch lovers, dig holes. That simple? Is it lunacy? I spent 8 years becoming a doctor, but I become a grave robber in one simple step, what I suppose people would call a ghoul." He crammed his fists against his mouth to stop some sound from coming out and felt for that interior coldness, that sense of disconnection. It was there, and Lewis drew it gratefully around him. When the couple finally walked on, Lewis watched them with nothing but impatience. They climbed the steps of one of the apartment buildings. The man felt for a key, and a moment later they were inside. The street was silent again, except for the constant beat of the wind, rustling the trees and tumbling his sweaty hair over his forehead. Lewis ran down to the fence, bent low, and felt through the bush for his canvas bundle. Here it was, rough under his fingers. He picked it up, listening to the muffled clank from inside. He carried it over to the broad gravel drive that led in through the gates and paused to orient himself. "Straight up here. Go left at the fork. No problem." He walked along the edge of the drive, wanting to be able to go farther into the shadow of the elms if there did happen to be a full-time caretaker, and if he happened to be out. He bore left at the fork, approaching Gage's grave now, and suddenly, appallingly, realized he could not remember what his son had looked like. He paused, staring off into the rows of graves, the frowning facades of the monuments, and tried to summon him up. Individual features came to him, his blonde hair, still so fine and light, his slanting eyes, his small white teeth, the little twist of scar on his chin from the time he had fallen down the back steps of their place in Chicago. He could see these things, but could not integrate them into a coherent whole. He saw Gage running toward the road, running toward his appointment with the Orinco truck. But Gage's face was turned away. He tried to summon up Gage as he had been in his crib on the night of the kite-flying day, and could see only darkness in his mind's eye. "Gage, where are you?" "Have you ever thought, Lewis, that you may not be doing your son any good service? Perhaps he's happy where he is. Maybe all of that isn't the bullshit you always thought it was. Maybe he's with the angels, or maybe he's just sleeping. And if he's sleeping, do you really know what it is you might wake up? Oh, Gage, where are you? I want you home with us." But was he really controlling his own actions? Why couldn't he summon up Gage's face? And why was he going against everyone's warning? Judd's, the dream of Pascal, the trepidation of his own troubled heart. He thought of the grave markers in the pet cemetery, those rude circles, spiraling down to the mystery, and then the coldness came over him again. Why was he standing here, trying to summon up Gage's face anyway? He would be seeing it soon enough. The headstone was here now. It read simply, "Gage William Creed," followed by the two dates. Someone had been here today to pay his or her respects, he saw. There were fresh flowers. Who would that have been? Missy Dandridge? His heart beat heavily but slowly in his chest. This was it, then. If he was going to do it, he had better start. There was only so much night ahead, and then the day would come. Lewis glanced into his heart one final time and saw that, yes, he did intend to go ahead with this. He nodded his head almost imperceptibly and fished for his pocket knife. He had cinched his bundle with Scotch strapping tape, and now he cut it. He unrolled the tarp at the foot of Gage's grave like a bedroll, and then arranged items in exactly the same way he would have arranged instruments to suture a cut or to perform a small in-office operation. Here was the flashlight, with its lens felted as the hardware store clerk had suggested. The felt was also secured with strapping tape. He made a small circle in the middle by placing a penny on the felt and cutting around it with a scalpel. Here was the short-handled pick, which he should not have to use. He had brought it only as a contingency. He would have no sealed cap to deal with, and he shouldn't run into any rocks in a newly filled grave. Here was the shovel, the spade, the length of rope, the work gloves. He put the gloves on, grabbed the spade, and started. The ground was soft, the digging easy. The grave's shape was well-defined, the dirt he was throwing out softer than the earth at the verge. His mind made a kind of automatic comparison between the ease of this dig and the rocky, unforgiving ground of the place where, if all went well, he would be reburying his son later on this night. Up there he would need the pick. Then he tried to stop thinking altogether. It only got in the way. He threw the dirt on the ground to the left of the grave, working into a steady rhythm that only became more difficult to maintain as the hole deepened. He stepped into the grave, smelling that dank aroma of fresh dirt, the smell he remembered from his summers with Uncle Carl. Digger, he thought, and stopped to wipe sweat from his brow. Uncle Carl had told him that was the nickname for every graveyard sexton in America. Their friends called them Digger. He started in again. He stopped only once more, and it was to check his watch. It was 12:20. He felt time slipping through his fist like something that had been greased. 40 minutes later, the spade gritted across something, and Lewis's teeth came down on his upper lip hard enough to bring blood. He got the flashlight and shone it down. Here was more dirt, and scrawled across it in a diagonal slash, a grayish silver line. It was the top of the grave liner. Lewis got most of the dirt off, but he was wary of making too much noise, and nothing was much louder than a shovel scraping across concrete in the dead of night. He climbed out of the grave and got the rope. This he threaded through the iron rings on one half of the segmented grave liner top. He got out of the grave again, spread out the tarpaulin, lay down on it, and grasped the ends of the rope. Lewis, I think this is it. Your last chance. You're right. It's my last chance, and I'm damned well taking it. He wound the ends of the rope around his hands and pulled. The square of concrete came up easily, gritting on the pivot end. It stood neatly upright over a square of blackness, now a vertical tombstone instead of a horizontal grave cover. Lewis pulled the rope out of the rings and tossed it aside. He wouldn't need it for the other half. He could stand on the sides of the grave liner and pull it up. He got down into the grave again, moving carefully, not wanting to overturn the cement slab he'd already pulled up and mash his toes or break the damned thing, which was quite thin. Pebbles rattled down into the hole, and he heard several of them chip hollowly off Gage's coffin. Bending, he grasped the other half of the graveliner top and pulled upward. As he did so, he felt something squelch coldly under his fingers. When he had this second half of the top standing on end, he looked down at his hand and saw a fat earthworm wriggling feebly there. With a choked cry of disgust, Lewis wiped it off on the earthen sidewall of his son's grave. Then he shone his flashlight downward. Here was the coffin he had last seen resting on chrome runners over the grave at the funeral service, surrounded by that ghastly green astroturf. This was the safety deposit box in which he was supposed to bury all his hopes for his son. Fury, clean and white-hot, the antithesis of his former coldness, rose up in him. Idiotic. The answer was no. Lewis groped for the spade and found it. He raised it over his shoulder and brought it down on the coffin's latch once, twice, a third time, a fourth. His lips were drawn back in a furious grimace. Going to break you out, Gage. See if I don't. The latch had splintered on the first stroke, and probably no more were necessary, but he went on, not wanting just to open the coffin, but to hurt it. Some kind of sanity finally returned, and he stopped with the spade raised for another blow. The blade was bent and scratched. He tossed it aside and scrambled out of the grave on legs that felt weak and rubbery. He felt sick to his stomach, and the anger had gone as quickly as it had come. In its place, the coldness flooded back in, and never in his life had his mind felt so alone and disconnected. He felt like an astronaut who has floated away from his ship during an EVA and now only drifts in a great blackness, breathing on borrowed time. Did Bill Baderman feel like this? He wondered. He lay on the ground, on his back this time, waiting to see if he was under control and ready to proceed. When the rubbery feeling had left his legs, he sat up and slipped back down into the grave. He shone the flashlight on the latch and saw it was not just broken, but demolished. He had swung the spade in a blind fury, but every blow he had struck had gone directly there, bullseye, as if guided. The wood around it had splintered. Lewis slipped the flashlight into his armpit. He squatted down slightly. His hands groped, like the hands of a catcher in a troop of circus flyers, waiting to perform his part in a mortal docking. He found the grooves in the lid, and he slipped his fingers into it. He paused for a moment. One could not rightly call it a hesitation. And then he opened his son's coffin. 50. Rachel Creed almost made her flight from Boston to Portland. Almost. Her Chicago plane left on time, a miracle in itself, was cleared straight into LaGuardia, another, and left New York only 5 minutes behind schedule. It got to the gate in Boston 15 minutes late, at 11:12 p.m. That left her with 13 minutes. She still might have made her connecting flight, but the shuttle bus, which makes a circle around the Logan terminals, was late. Rachel waited, now in a kind of constant low-grade panic, shifting from foot to foot as if she needed to go to the bathroom, switching the travel bag her mother had loaned her from one shoulder to the other. When the shuttle still hadn't come at 11:25, she began to run. Her heels were low, but still high enough to cause her problems. One of her ankles buckled painfully, and she paused long enough to take off the shoes. Then she ran on in her pantyhose, past Allegheny and Eastern Airlines, breathing hard now, getting the beginnings of a stitch in her side. Her breath was hot in her throat, that tuck in her side deeper and more painful. Now she was running past the international terminal, and there, up ahead, was Delta's triangular sign. She burst in through the doors, almost dropped one shoe, juggled it, caught it. It was 11:37. One of the two clerks on duty glanced up at her. Flight 104, she panted. The Portland flight. Has it left? The clerk glanced behind him at the monitor. Still at the gate, it says here, he said. But they called for final boarding 5 minutes ago. I'll call ahead. Bags to check? No, Rachel gasped, and brushed her sweaty hair out of her eyes. Her heart was galloping in her chest. Then don't wait for me to call. I will, but I advise you to run very fast. Rachel didn't run very fast. She was no longer able, but she did as well as she could. The escalator had been turned off for the night, and she pounded up the stairs, tasting copper shavings in her mouth. She reached the security checkpoint and almost threw the tote bag at the startled female guard, then waited for it to come through on the conveyor belt, her hands clenching and unclenching. It was barely out of the X-ray chamber before she had snatched it up by the strap and ran again, the bag flying out behind her and then banging her on the hip. She looked up at one of the monitors as she ran. Flight 104, Portland, scheduled 11:25 p, gate 31, boarding. Gate 31 was at the far end of the concourse, and even as she snatched her glance at the monitor, boarding in steady letters changed to departing, blinking rapidly. A frustrated cry burst from her. She ran into the gate area just in time to see the gate attendant removing the strips, which read, Flight 104, Boston, Portland, 11:25. It's gone? She asked incredulously. It's really gone? The attendant looked at her sympathetically. It rolled out of the jetway at 11:40. I'm sorry, ma'am. You made a hell of a good try, if that's any consolation. He pointed out the wide glass windows. Rachel could see a big 727 with Delta markings, its running lights, Christmas tree bright, starting its takeoff roll. Christ, did anyone tell you I was coming? Rachel cried. When they called up here from downstairs, 104 was on an active taxiway. If I'd called her back, she would have gotten caught in the parade going out to runway 30. And that pilot would have had my behind on a platter, not to mention the 100 or so passengers on board. I'm very sorry. If you'd been even 4 minutes sooner. She walked away, not listening to the rest. She was halfway back to the security checkpoint when waves of faintness rode over her. She stumbled into another gate area and sat down until the darkness had passed. Then she slipped her shoes back on, picking a squashed lark cigarette butt off the tattered sole of one stocking first. "My feet are dirty and I don't give a fuck," she thought disconsolately. She walked back toward the terminal. The security guard eyed her sympathetically. "Missed it?" "I missed it all right," Rachel said. "Where were you headed?" "Portland. Then Bangor." "Well, why don't you rent a car? If you really have to be there, that is. Ordinarily, I'd advise a hotel close to the airport, but if I ever saw a lady who looked like she really had to be there, you are that lady." "I'm that lady, all right," Rachel said. She thought about it. "Yes, I suppose I could do that, couldn't I? If any of the agencies has a car." The security guard laughed. "Oh, they'll have cars. Only time they don't have cars at Logan is when the airport's fogged in, which is a lot of the time." Rachel barely heard her. In her mind, she was already trying to calculate it. She couldn't get to Portland in time to catch her Bangor flight, even if she bulleted up the turnpike at a suicidal pace. So, figure driving straight through. How long? That depended on how far. 250 miles, that was the figure which came to mind. Something Judd had said, maybe. It was going to be at least 12:15 before she got going, probably closer to 12:30 a.m. It was all turnpike. She thought that her chances of going the whole distance at 65 without getting hauled down for speeding were reasonably good. She ran the figures quickly in her head, dividing 65 into 250. Not quite 4 hours. Well, say four even. She would have to stop once and go to the bathroom. And although sleep seemed impossibly distant now, she knew her own resources well enough to believe she would also have to stop for a great big black coffee. Still, she could be back in Ludlow before first light. Mulling all this over, she started for the stairs. The car rental desks were one level down from the concourses. "Good luck, honey," the security guard called. "Take care." "Thanks," Rachel said. She felt that she deserved some good luck.